You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
The Athletic.
Well, you know the famous saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. It's not necessarily a philosophy that FIFA buys into. The World Cup is changing beyond all recognition just months after we had the best World Cup ever. What's happening and why? We'll tell you all the news and views from Planet FIFA. I'm Mark Chapman. This is the Athletic Football Podcast.
Now calling on the Congress to give a round of applause to elect Gianni Infantino as the FIFA president for the period from 2023 to 2027.
All those who love me, and I know there are so many, and those who hate me, I know there are few. I love you all, of course, today especially.
The sycophancy. It just sends shivers down your spine.
I struggle with the idea of just saying like countries basically should just accept we're never going to get that. I think it's one of the better things Infantino's done.
One of the stories we were expecting was more on their 2030 bid. I think that's gone away.
So joining us today to discuss the future of international football, the Athletic's football reporters Matt Slater and Adam Crafton and deputy editor Laura Williamson. It's the first this of a podcast doubleheader. So today we'll talk about the international game. Tomorrow, we'll turn our attention to the changes being made at club level. I'm going to start with you, Matt, because you went to FIFA's Congress last week, which was in Rwanda. The main headlines were what?
I suppose the main headline was that 4 more years of Infantino, though we did kind of know that. He was running unopposed. So he got in by acclamation, is where everyone basically stands up and claps. Not everyone, but most people. We got a bit more information on the Club World Cup. There was a kind of reverse ferret that again had been trailed. So the next world men's World Cup 2026 is not going to be 16 groups of three. It's going to be 12 groups of four, which means the tournament will have 104 games and will run for 39 days. Now, we can talk a little bit more about that, but that is, I think, quite significant. Lots of other little bits of buzz, but I suppose those were the main headlines.
Okay. Did you also, by the way, compare his 2016 presidential campaign to Rwanda's recovery from genocide?
Right. Well, this does divide people. So I'll give you a little bit of context here. He did an opening address where, to me, and I would say most of the people, the vast majority of the people in the room who I spoke to, and I really did talk to a lot of people about this because I just wanted to make sure that it wasn't just, you know, my bias or, you know, me sort of thinking the worst of stuff that comes out of Infantino's mouth. But the majority, vast majority, I would say, of the people in the room who heard it, heard him say, like an anecdote about a previous time he'd been to Rwanda, or the first time he'd been to Rwanda, actually, was in the run-up when he was on the campaign trail in 2016, the very first time. And he'd come to Rwanda to try and win the votes, the African bloc vote. And he found out he wasn't going to get the votes. So he was very disappointed, packing his bags and all this sort of stuff. But he went to Kigali's Rwanda Genocide Memorial, which is by all accounts absolutely amazing. I didn't have time to get there. He told this story that, no, I'm not going to give up. I'm going to carry on, and you know, and sort of like Rwanda's incredible recovery from genocide. You know, here I am today, and I'm in front of you again today. So that sounded to me like he was comparing the two, his sort of campaign trail, keep going, try again with Rwanda's recovery. However, I asked him about it in the press conference and he got very angry. We'd already had a clash over something else. He said I was completely wrong. And how could anyone think that he'd ever compare something as bad and as awful as that to anything from his life? And other people, I would say a minority said, no, no, come on, look, you know, you are being a bit harsh there. He clearly was, it might have been a bit clumsy the way he phrased it, but he was saying he took inspiration from Rwanda's recovery from. So that's that story.
Okay. When you look at this, Laura, whilst the personnel may be different, it looks like FIFA in many ways just has never moved on. I mean, if you look at the FIFA documentary on Netflix, there are patterns that still continue today. I mean, a man running unopposed for the presidency and just people standing up and clapping their approval for him. It nothing has changed.
No, it's a fascinating study of sort of what power does to people, isn't it? I mean, you know, when he comes out with that speech about Infantino about, to those of you who love me, and there are many, and to those of you who hate me, and yes, I know there are a few. And then, you know, somebody pipes up, we love you, Mr. President. It's just the sycophancy is, well, it just sends shivers down your spine. But I think the point remains that once these people climb that greasy ladder and get there, and let's face it, make a lot of money for the organisation that they represent, then it becomes very, very difficult to dislodge them.
The other thing, though, I think it is important to say, Adam, is that the four of us are viewing this from a Western European perspective. And we always have to take into account, with international sport, that the Western European way doesn't necessarily make it the right way, and that there are plenty of countries globally who have benefited from the leadership of a whole variety of men, because it tends to be men, in a whole variety of organisations.
Yeah. I went to Suriname before the World Cup, and Suriname are a very, very small football nation, you know, never been to a World Cup, but they do have half a chance of making 2026 because of the expanded nature and because you have three teams that automatically qualify with USA, Canada and Mexico. And I asked their president of their local football association what he made of Infantino. And he said, well, Gianni's my great friend. He's been to visit twice. You know, there's a plaque on the wall outside this very, very small FA building, which says unveiled by Gianni Infantino, some local football pitches. And the thing that FIFA have done for Suriname that's very important is when Suriname play in things like pre-qualifying or friendlies against, Haiti or countries that are local in some way, they were finding the costs incredibly burdensome, incredibly, incredibly difficult to go and do 2 or 3 days to do the plane travel, the hotels, to get players who might be playing in Europe over to Suriname in Central South America. And FIFA expanded that pot of money. And that is basically just, that will lock in Suriname's vote forever, really, for Infantino. I think that's why you do have these very, very small nations who all have one vote now, basically saying, well, you know, okay, he's a bit crass on the big international stage, but he does just about enough to look after us.
Yeah. I mean, at some point in all of this, Laura, everyone has to understand that whilst you're constantly meant to look at the bigger picture and the greater good and whatever, self-interest has to play a part at some level.
It does. And one of the big things Infantino was keen to get across in Rwanda was how much money FIFA as an organisation is making. And it's been phenomenally successful on that front. And if that money is trickling down to these smaller nations, then of course they're gonna back him to continue what he's doing. I think it's a wider question, really, of what we want the World Cup to be. You know, do we want the minnows to get there and make money and have their chance in the spotlight, or do we actually want it to be the same old names, the same old teams, and the players we all know about?
And interestingly, Matt, Gab Marcotti wrote this for ESPN last week. If you're sniffy about quality, then international football isn't for you, and neither is lower division football. And basically every single game other than the Champions League knockout stages. Big Six clashes in the Premier League, the Clásico, and a few other choice matches. Sorry. Do you agree with that?
No, not really. I know the point he's making. I mean, if you are an absolute stickler for what I'm watching has to be the best of the best, right? So if I like opera, I can only go to, like, say, half a dozen opera houses or theatre, et cetera, right? But the beauty of sport is it's competition. So it's Laura's point, right? I want to see a good contest. And one of the things I'm endlessly, pleasantly surprised at, particularly if you support bad football teams like I do, is the actual, you know, quality argument goes a long way down. The number of, like, decent footballers this nation produces, decent rugby players, decent cricket players, as long as it's a good contest, fine. I watch school sport. I watch all sorts of amateur sport. That side, I don't necessarily buy. I know the point he's making, but I do quite like seeing Champions League knockout games, right? That's different. It's a different experience for me. But then I get quite a lot of enjoyment from seeing a really good National League game or a really good, you know, under 18 game of rugby.
Because you've got the competitive balances about right.
That's the point. Now, look, you can get duds of all varieties, right? You can get a bad game, blowouts, just flat performances, bad weather, bad ref. All sorts of things can, like, ruin the quality of a game that you're watching. But is it fair? Is there something on the line that normally helps, right? Is there some, you know, is this game important? So those are the things that's why I enjoy sport. But I know the point Gab's making.
Adam?
I think he makes a fair point. I mean, it's an interesting one in terms of, you know, as a journalist who might go to that World Cup, I mean, another week in USA, Canada and Mexico doesn't sound that bad. I think for most people who will be going to that World
Laura,
Cup.
Laura, are you responsible for sending it?
Noted.
You know,
noted.
He's already making it sound like a holiday.
Well, he's off to Miami for a month, clearly.
And there is also a fair point that these very, very small nations, the only way they can really progress is by being exposed to these tournaments, by having the exposure that comes with it, the revenue that comes from it, the resources that come from it. Unless we do basically say, you know, there are some countries that are just too small to ever compete in the World Cup. Because I think that is the situation we're probably currently in. You know, one of the best stories in the last World Cup was probably, you know, Saudi Arabia beating Argentina. But Saudi Arabia aren't a Suriname, right? Like, you know, in terms of what they're spending on sport and what they're spending on football, the size of the population, the potential in terms of the age of the population. And they've been to beat to World Cups before. So I struggle with the idea of just saying, like, countries basically should just accept we're never going to get that. I think it's one of the better things Infantino's done.
Well, I always use an example, Laura, as growing up, England used to put 8 or 9 past Turkey, for example, in the early and mid-80s. You know, Turkey, absolute minnow. And you fast forward to, what was it, 2002 World Cup? They were semi-finalists. And through that time, there was an expanded Euros and so on and so forth. So in some ways, whilst this does seem a ridiculously sized tournament, the benefit for some of these countries will, well, be seen long after I'm working on podcasts. I mean, it'll be in 2050, you might see the benefit for Suriname.
Yeah, that's it. And maybe we do just have to sort of suck up the fact that in women's football, it's always leveled that because there are so few elite teams that you do get your 13-0s, you do get your 10-0s, and they're incredibly dull to watch. And maybe we have to suck that up in men's football at World Cup level for a little bit to bring up those smaller nations on. But because I think those, it won't be 13-0, obviously, but I think those chasms of quality will happen with 48 teams. It's just got to. I mean, the Women's World Cup's got 32 this time. You know, Haiti are in England's group. There's a risk there that could be, you know, a cricket score. But as Adam says, and I think he's right, you've got to take that for the long-term gain, potentially.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
The biggest complaint, Matt, is surely just, on the one hand, it feels slightly unmanageable that 40 more games, 104 games in total, but also the fact that by, it doesn't matter whether you have 16 three-team groups or now what they're going to do with, what was it, 12 four-team groups, you're still going to have, well, one, it's a bit of a clumsy mechanic because you're going to have eight third-place teams going through. And secondly, you're still going to end up with quite a few meaningless games, aren't you?
Yeah, look, it's not an ideal tournament if you're designing it from a sort of structure point of view, because you're right, it's a loss of games to only boot out 16 of them, right? Because you've got to sort of manufacture this round of 32. So in some ways, we play a lot of games to get to a really good, quite old-fashioned cup format, 32, 16, 8, 4. And, you know, I think people will find that great and exciting if they're still watching. It makes me think of, like, Rugby World Cups, which are very, very long, and they are, you know, attritional affairs. But that's because they need quite a long time between games. Football hasn't quite got that excuse. But because it's jamming so many teams in, I think the length of it will be interesting. It's one of those things I don't think we'll know until we see it. I was sort of mentioning it to mates of mine at the weekend, and they were like, yeah, but we're all going to watch, aren't we? In the same way that, you know, we somehow got through those four games a day in Qatar, we all watched. What I think,
but some will be watched, kind of as wallpaper.
I think so.
Whereas the majority in a 32 team are probably watched with a bit more intent.
Yeah, I agree. I would agree with that. But like I said, I think it's just going to be one of those things that we won't really know until we've been through one. I think probably the biggest reason that they correctly went from 16 times 3 to 12 times 4 is to bring back more meaningful, more games of Jeopardy, right? So you were in the 16 times 3, you were losing one of the most exciting 4 or 5 days of Qatar, where you had, I think it was 4 days in a row of all four teams in each group having sort of simultaneous kickoffs and lots happening. You know, the sort of, remember, was it Spain, Germany, that Costa Rica day where teams were in and out and, you know, the group was changing on a sort of almost minute-by-minute basis. That was exciting. And when you had game 16 times three, well, you had one team sitting out watching it, and you had also the possibility of collusion as well between the two teams that did have a final fixture, getting the fixture, the result they wanted to boot, you know, to get the other team out. So I think they've got there eventually. It does mean a load more games, and you're right, there's a danger of too much being a good thing. I'm like, oh my God, how do we do all this? Do they need another venue, which brings cost? So there's going to be lots of travel. Yeah, loads of things to sort out. But I think the format is better than it was.
I also don't think you'll end up, you know, we're talking about sort of these minnows getting in. You might get one or two. But, you know, if you think from a European point of view, you know, there were some pretty big countries that weren't actually at the World Cup. Think about, was Sweden there?
No.
Norway?
Italy,
right?
No. So the way to think about it is Haaland wasn't there, Ibrahimovic wasn't there, Mo Salah wasn't there. So, you know, Infantino's made this point when asked about quality. He's like, he'll list off like 10 big teams that weren't there with stars. That's the other thing, with stars.
Ibrahimovic can't see.
Well, he won't be.
By the time he gets to 2020, blimey.
Yeah, I know.
Go on, Adam, finish your point there.
No, that was my point. My point was that, you know, we're kind of all worrying about these are all going to be non-fixtures, and you will get some of that. What it will do is mean the qualifying is just utterly awful.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, it's already awful. It will be even worse.
But your point about stars is absolutely right, that's what Infantino, that's what FIFA want. They want the big names there because that's how people follow football.
That's,
you know,
what we want.
We saw it. We saw it in Qatar, didn't we, with all the names of shirts on them.
Yeah.
You know, that's what people want to watch.
Well, I think the qualifying point, you know, you are diluting the quality, the importance of qualifying. And I think that is a possible unintended consequence or a knock-on effect that maybe FIFA will want to have a look at, because that Suriname point that Adam was making about you know, what's important for them? Well, qualifying tournaments are actually quite important for them. There's whole parts of the world that doesn't play enough football, doesn't have enough meaningful fixtures. And one of the things that often gets said about Europe is, you've stopped playing friendlies against us. You know, Europe has now come up with this Nations League tournament. Again, it's sort of kind of putting a big ren fence, almost like this gated community. We're getting richer and richer and richer. And what FIFA is trying to do, and, you know, it annoys people here and it annoys players and players' unions, and, you know, but it's got this point. Well, look, Europe's galloping away. They've stopped sharing that wealth through fixtures, because they said that fixtures were rubbish and, you know, the clubs didn't like them. So we've invented this little tournament that suits us. And one of the things that, let's say, CONCACAF has, or Africa has, or Asia has, is, well, they've still got qualifying tournaments, and they are their best fixtures, their best TV money. But you, by expanding the World Cup, you do kind of dilute the quality of that. So there's a little bit of kind of, you know, balancing act going on. And that's why it's so important that Infantino, at these annual congresses, absolutely hammers home the point, this is how much money I was giving you every year in 2016. This is how much I'm giving you now, every year, all of you. Our money, your money, look at our revenues. Up, 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 up. So he's constantly reinforcing that point. You're all getting more money. Sevenfold. When I came in 2016, he dished out about $250,000 per member association. It's $2 million-ish now. And we're about to go into a new World Cup cycle, because all of FIFA's budgets are done on World Cup cycles, where they're going to double it again. So Qatar was really successful. The next one's going to be pretty much twice.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
On to the Women's World Cup, and you mentioned the heavy scorelines that there are sometimes in tournaments and in qualifying. A heavy scoreline in a men's game, whilst people go, oh God, it's ridiculous that there are 48 teams in this World Cup, or whatever it may be, doesn't necessarily hammer the product, right? I noticed that there will be more criticism of the product in a one-sided game in women's football. Is that fair, that there is more criticism? And B, is that a problem, do you think, going into this Women's World Cup?
I think you're definitely right. There's definitely more scrutiny. It's straight away. It's, well, yeah, well, it's just rubbish, isn't it? Because, you know, other team, you know, people don't take into account that the other team are not even part-time, or their infrastructure, or the rest of it. It's just, as a TV spectacle, it's rubbish. Particularly rubbish when the winning team stops scoring goals out of sympathy, which drives me up the wall. I think there is a risk that might happen in the group stage. I mean, they've gone from 32 teams. That is a lot in a sport that is still developing. But the view seems to be that it's a positive thing, because, again, to Adam's point, you just get more nations involved, and people can see sort of more of what women's football's about. But the key will be telling those stories, rather than it just being, you know, Haiti turning up and getting hammered by Denmark and England in that group.
Was Infantino right then, Adam, to take aim at broadcasters who criticise FIFA for not offering equal prize money by saying, well, they don't offer enough for the rights? I mean, FIFA's prize pot for this Women's World Cup is £150 million, which is five times bigger than it was 4 years ago.
But it's still not as big as the men's one, is it?
At the moment. But Infantino's point being, well, you broadcasters don't give us the same amount of money for the Women's World Cup as you do for the Men's World Cup.
Yeah. And I think he's got a point to a certain extent. I think his point was the same broadcasters that are offering us that money will then go and criticise FIFA for not giving the bigger fund, or where are we meant to find this money? Well, unfortunately for Gianni, you've also just spent half your speech telling everyone how rich you are. So yeah. you've kind of trapped yourself, and they've done that as well with there's this fund that, you know, that clubs receive from FIFA to release players during these major tournaments, both in men's football and women's football. And one of the unintended consequences of Gianni Infantino running around the room saying all these billions that they're earning is clubs are now turning around and saying, should we get a bigger slice of this? You know, should we be paid more than what we were? To go back to your question in terms of the broadcasters, the answer is probably somewhere in the middle of that. You know, yes, there probably should be a greater competition, you know, in terms of to bid for those rights. You know, was there the same sort of, I suppose, bidding war that you would see for the Men's World Cup? There is also, of course, there's always going to be a degree of economic reality in this, in terms of how much money will it make the company that is bidding for it. I think it is slightly different on two levels, whether, you know, with a state broadcaster, whether it's, you know, something like the BBC or something, where I kind of feel like they have a responsibility to get those rights, but also a responsibility, if it's taxpayers' money, not to overpay for those rights at the same time. So it's all very, 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 very complicated, which probably is not what any woman working in football wants to hear, that it's all very complicated and we're all thinking very deeply about it.
And it's playing catch up. You know, historically, Matt, it is playing catch up on a competitive level, on a commercial level, on a financial level. You know, I'll often go back to the 100 in the cricket, whereby the prize money is equal right at the very start because it's a new tournament and they've been able to do that. Having said that, there are still disparities in what the men are paid and what the women are paid, because there is a historical nature to trying to catch that up.
Oh, it's huge. And you know, we have these debates, don't we, when we talk about the WSL and where the club game is in England, and to the men's game, do they subsidise it enough? Should they subsidise it at all? Yeah, it's a tough one, right? And I, there are good arguments on both sides. I think Adam's point that FIFA could, if it wanted to, do this, because, as you say, with one hand, he spends 20 minutes talking about how successful FIFA is. It's just a, you know, commercial beast. Oh, and by the way, we've now got $4 billion in our reserves, right? But then with his final point, which I thought was a good point, you know, he actually said, you know, when people are asking us for our rights, for our Women's World Cup rights, particularly, you know, particularly these public service broadcasters, and he sort of made this point about taxpayers' money, they're offering 100th, he said, 100th, 1% of what they were willing to pay for the men's rights, despite the fact that their audience figures are only, let's say, 20% lower. That to me felt like a reasonable point. And he said, he actually then said, offer us 25% less, offer us 50% less, and we'll do the rest. So then again, you know, there is a, you know, that classic sort of the men's game subsidising the women's game for a time, until hopefully we can all reach the point where, let's say, women's tennis is. Now that's going to take a while.
I do think one of the issues I have with the way that any governing body goes about growing women's football is, for some reason, they feel like they have to mirror the approach taken by the men's game. So in 2019, it went up, didn't it, from 24 teams at the World Cup to 32. But if I was in FIFA's position, I would have kept it at 24, actually. I would have taken the flip side to what I've just said and actually said to nations, if you want to get into this tournament, you have to go and invest, right? You have to go and invest as a nation, as a government. And this is where, again, it becomes difficult for FIFA, because they don't like governments interfering in football too much. But I think that's the way they have to go about it. And the other thing is, you know, do you have to sell the TV rights all to individual broadcasters in the same way as you do with men's football? Do you actually do a direct-to-consumer service? Do you take that gamble on women's football? Do you design this World Cup, this Women's World Cup, as actually a bit of a Super League-style tournament, that you're only going to see brilliant games between really good teams, between really advanced nations, from a footballing perspective? I don't know. I just think at times it's all oh, well, this is what the men have done for years, so we're going to mirror it exactly, and then we're going to complain when we don't get exactly the same amount of money for it.
And the other bit is with the Women's World Cup, certainly from a UK perspective, it's got to be accessible. It's got to be on free-to-air. But like you say, Adam, why couldn't you rip it up and do it in a completely different way? Put it on YouTube, get more eyeballs on it. But they they won't do that because, you know, that takes some thinking outside the box. And they've got their, they're very proud, FIFA, of their commercial strategy for the women's tournament, which they've tried to make it independent from the men's equivalent, so you won't get necessarily the same sponsors that we see around the men's tournament. And then what do? They sign a deal with Visit Saudi, which just beggars belief that nobody at FIFA HQ thought, oh, hang on, this is a tournament in which women are playing. And what are women's rights like in Saudi Arabia? And also, a lot of these players are openly gay, and they are not allowed to be that in Saudi Arabia. So why on earth, when they get to Australia and get off the plane, do they want to walk past a banner that says Visit Saudi, where you can't be what you are? Like, it just beggars belief that nobody thought, oh, hang on, this might be an issue. And that's what we are.
I think they did think it was an issue very belatedly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But that's the point. Which is why they didn't public announce it. Which is why Infantino could sit there, you know, as bold as brass in the post-Congress press conference and say, "Storm in a teacup." You know, actually, that's what he said.
Yeah.
You know, we had discussions, whereas we know because we've seen, you know, some documents. There were more discussions, and I've spoken to people in Australia who know it was more than discussions. This was something that was done and then had to be undone.
And how it is undone is going to be very interesting, right? Because Saudi Arabia is basically being humiliated as a result of, I suppose, FIFA not having the foresight to recognise the storm that was coming. And I think the reason they didn't have the foresight was probably partially because actually, yeah, during the Men's World Cup, Visit Saudi was everywhere. And you could kind of do that because, one, because it was in Qatar. So, you know, it's already in Qatar. You may as well have Visit Saudi at that point. And the other thing is nobody in men's football had a single thing to say about it.
No.
And you actually had the best, you know, the player who lifted the World Cup as the ambassador for the Saudi Tourist Board. I mean, in Messi, and obviously Ronaldo goes off there. I think they completely underpriced the willingness of women and also organisations when it comes to representing women to actually just to complain about it.
That's what I found fascinating, that, you know, in Qatar, we had all that, you know, with the back and two, with the armbands and governing bodies getting themselves in a bright old state about how to protest and all the rest of it. And when the Athletic broke the Visit Saudi story, we went to every single football association involved in the tournament and asked them for a comment. And some of them commented on the record, most of them didn't. But then the first time Alex Morgan is at a press conference, what does she say? She goes in two-footed. And then Rapinoe follows her up. And then and Beth Mead said something. You know, it kept going. And it makes it impossible for FIFA to wave it through. I think... Yeah, it was a brilliant example of player power.
And it was the players. Yeah. I spoke to FIFA sources about it. You could argue, you know, with reasonable grounds, they are quite thick-skinned about governments moaning at them. Because as Infantino said, when he did the storm in a teacup thing, it was just discussions, wasn't a deal. He then went, I'm a little bit intrigued by this whole debate because Australia and Saudi Arabia has loads of trade. He had the number 1.5 billion, and it seems fine when governments have trade with Saudi Arabia or anywhere else that might be a little bit problematic. But when an international federation, which is, you know, all of you, all of us, and we're all equal, is a problem. So look, you know, he's still there, still a bit annoyed.
It's an issue as well for FIFA going forwards, because if I'm a sponsor considering going to do something with FIFA in future, I'm looking at Qatar and seeing Budweiser get themselves into a really difficult situation, basically because the host nation decided they didn't fancy it a couple of days before the World Cup. in Qatar. And then you've got this situation with Visit Saudi, where they've basically, you know, the Saudis, in terms from a commercial point of view, have done nothing wrong in terms of their approach. FIFA said, we'd quite like to get into a deal with you. We're doing a deal. FIFA say, that sounds great. We're going to do a deal. And then all of a sudden, FIFA back out of it. So you've almost had two tournaments in a row where sponsorships have had to be pulled. And maybe FIFA would contest the language there because they would say it wasn't announced. But in essence, two sponsorships have been pulled because of the values of the host nation in some way. And that's a really, really interesting thing moving forwards in terms of how do sponsors and host nations and FIFA go about that? You know, because if Visit Saudi can't do this one, can they do the Men's World Cup in 2026 in the States and Canada and Mexico? You'd think that's going to be very, very difficult. So then FIFA all of a sudden looking for alternative revenue streams when tourist boards are pretty good value.
I was going to make one sort of, you know, final Saudi Arabia point. Saudi Arabia, as a story, was very quiet in Rwanda. One of the stories we were expecting was more on their 2030 bid. I think that's gone away. I mean, I never really believed it anyway. I thought it was too soon after Qatar and I thought there were big problems. But we got news on Tuesday, this story that we'd heard for a while, that Spain and Portugal were going to team up with Morocco. They bring African votes. You got Spain, Portugal, Morocco there. It's fantastic, you know, little kind of geographic. It makes sense, you know, football hotbeds. I think they're the new hot favourites for 2030. I think that makes it really, really hard for Saudi Arabia to bid. And they were quiet. The Saudis were quiet. So I, you know, and I think I also mentioned the international match calendar thing, which is too complicated to squeeze into now. But it actually makes it quite hard for another Winter World Cup. Because that would require like a sort of 10-year plan to find the room.
When Matt starts to threaten talking about an international match calendar with the excitement that he has for the international match calendar, it's time to bring this podcast to a close. We'll talk more tomorrow. We're going to turn our attention back to club football and the murkier waters of FIFA against UEFA. There's changes to the Champions League rules around multi-club ownership as well. There's plenty to get into. If you haven't got an Athletic subscription yet, then head to theathletic.com/footballpod for our latest offer of £1.99 a month for 12 months, and we'll see you tomorrow.
The Athletic.